I'm Dr. Diana Zuckerman. I'm president of the National Research Center for Women and Families. And we're an independent nonprofit organization that focuses on improving the health and safety of adults and children. And we do work on a lot of FDA issues, and I was assuming the audience would be filled with people who don't understand how the FDA works, and since we don't have that, but we do have some people perhaps in that boat, I will try to do my best to keep my remarks appropriate for the audience. I would like to say that the National Research Center for Women and Families is a strong critic of the FDA, but we're also one of its greatest fans. And the reason why we are critical is because we believe so strongly in the mission of the FDA and are so committed to strengthening its role. So with that introduction, I'm going to focus my remarks on medical devices, but because I assumed the audience might not understand the FDA process, I'm going to be more general and try to put this in the whole context of public health as well as the FDA as a regulatory agency and how it functions to preserve the public health. Given this is APHA, I don't think I have to remind you what Mark Twain said. Three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And we all know that we can use statistics to prove almost anything that we want, but sometimes it's easier to do that than other times. Now, there are two ways to prove that an unsafe product is safe, and I wanted to just put that context into start. You can have no research, or you can have bad research. If you have no research, you can make a fact. You can say, and it's factually correct, that no research has been published showing that something is unsafe. But then you can spin that to say, there's no evidence that this product is unsafe. And obviously that's different. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
Someone's helping on that right now. Thank you.
Thanks. Great. Perfect. Thank you. Okay. So, in other words, it's easy to say that something might be safe if there's no research, if no research at all has been done. Now, for FDA approval, does the FDA approval mean that something is safe? FDA generally has a different criteria. You don't have to have somebody proving that a product is unsafe. The companies have to actually prove that the product is safe in most instances. And so the criteria for prescription drugs, for example, is that the product be safe, usually as tested over the short term, that it be effective, usually compared to placebo, not to other drugs. And as I just said, the lack of data proving dangers isn't sufficient. But the caveat is that the studies that the FDA looks at are done by the company whose product is being considered. The studies are not done by the FDA. The FDA does not analyze the data themselves or do the study themselves, although they may reanalyze the data that the company has provided. Now, so for the approval of drugs at the FDA, remember that safe and effective does not mean that nobody will ever die from this drug. It does not mean that nobody will ever be harmed by this drug. It doesn't necessarily mean this drug is safe for long-term use. Almost always the studies are done in the short term to see if it's safe in the short term, and sometimes they require studies be done after approval to look at the long term. And it does not mean that this drug is more effective than other drugs, even more effective than cheaper drugs. So all it usually means is that this drug is effective compared to placebo, but it may actually be much less effective than a drug that's been on the market for a long time and that might actually be sold for less money. So from a public health point of view, that's important to know. Now, the FDA approval of medical devices is somewhat different. First of all, instead of the criteria of safe and effective, which is the criteria used for drugs, it's reasonably safe and reasonably effective. And that's a little bit vague. It's a little bit unclear exactly what that means. Usually it means that for most people, there are benefits that outweigh the risks, but that doesn't mean that's true for all people. And it can, and medical devices can be approved even if they have substantial risks for some people, although usually you would hope it would not be approved if it had substantial risks for most people. But there's a loophole in the FDA law, and I should just mention that the FDA had the authority to regulate prescription drugs many years before it had the authority to regulate devices. So it didn't get the authority to regulate devices until 1976 because of the problems with the Dalcon Shield, which was found to cause infertility and even death because of infections. And it was that women's device, that implanted device, that caused the Congress to pass a law giving FDA the authority to regulate devices. But they put a caveat in the law, a little loophole in the law, which was meant, I believe, to be temporary. And that was to say, well, there are a lot of grandfathered devices that are going to stay on the market, at least unless we find there's good reason to take them off the market. And what if a company comes in and wants to approve a device that's already on the market? Maybe they just want to tinker with it, make it a little better, and we don't want to discourage them from doing that by making them go through this long, more extensive safety process. So the loophole was if a company had a device that was substantially equivalent to something that was already on the market, they would not have to go through the same lengthy process of approval that other companies would have to go through, which is very similar to the process that drug companies go through and the new process that device companies would have to go through. And that loophole is called the 510K. It's named after the part of the law. Now, when FDA requires short-term studies on implanted medical devices, and I give two examples, jaw implants and breast implants, these were both grandfathered devices. These were devices that were already on the market before 1976. They had already been put in X number of mostly women, obviously breast implants, mostly women, and although not entirely, and jaw implants, also mostly women. So at this time, they required the companies to do some studies that were prospective studies to look at how safe and effective these products were for a period ranging from about 3 months to 3 years, depending on the different studies. And the justification of not requiring a longer-term study, even though these products had been on the market for many years, was that, well, if they were really so terrible, we would know that by now, so we don't really have to require a retrospective study of women who've had breast implants for the last 15 years or whatever. So that was the justification. And the other thing that contributed to this feeling was that there were epidemiological studies that had been done, particularly for breast implants. And for example, there was a study that was quoted as saying, we're studying women who've had breast implants for up to 41 years. That was a study of connective tissue diseases. And there was another study that said, we've studied women who've had breast implants since 1970, and that was a study of cancer. And the results of those two studies, done not by FDA and not given to the FDA, but by other researchers, was that they didn't find cancer and they didn't find connective tissue disease in these two studies, and therefore they said the body of research shows that these implants are safe. But what those studies didn't emphasize is the fact that although the women could have had the implants for many years, to be in the study they only had to have the breast implants for 1 month or longer. And obviously, as public health people, that if people have have an exposure for only 1 month or only 2 months or only a year or only 2 years, they're not going to develop cancer. And also, another thing is that one of the studies that said that the women in the study had had breast implants for up to 41 years, that was actually not possible. That study was published in 1995. Breast implants were not invented until 1962. So even if the very first woman who ever got a breast implant was in that study, she could not have had implants for more than 33 years. And in fact, they didn't have the very first woman who had ever had breast implants, and hardly any women had breast implants in the 1960s. So their data was not exactly accurate, and yet it was published in, I think, the New England Journal of Medicine, and nobody questioned what was really a very obvious error. In the meantime, the National Cancer Institute did some studies on breast implants, and they had findings that looked very different. And perhaps the reason was that the studies that found these, that gave implants a clean bill of health had been funded by Dow Corning, which was in litigation to try to decrease their payments and also to fix their reputation after they had been sued, and they had had a settlement for over $3 billion because of women who had been harmed. So when the National Cancer Institute did a study, all the women had implants for at least 7 years, and they found substantial, statistically significant health problems. When the industry funded the studies, they concluded the product was safe. But even so, that was the background upon which FDA was looking at whether these products really were safe for long-term use, because they only had required 2 or 3 years of research when they were deciding whether to approve them. Now I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about this big loophole, this 510K loophole for medical devices. This is the biggest public health problem that I see for devices. Depending on who you ask, somewhere between 90 and 98% of devices that are reviewed by the FDA every year go through the 510K process, and 90% of those do not require any clinical trials at all. So they do have to show some evidence of safety, but not in a clinical trial, not in the usual way. And so I'm going to just give a couple of examples. If you remember, the contact lens solution Renew with Moisture Lock was approved. It was approved as substantially equivalent to another contact lens solution. No clinical trials were required. No inspection of the manufacturing plant was required. And the result was that this new product was found to cause infections and even blindness. And quite a few people had to have corneal transplants as a result of the infections caused by that. And what I'd like to say about contact lens solution is I've been wearing contact lenses since I was 16, and I've never heard anybody complain that there weren't enough good contact lens solutions on the market. You know, it's not like this was an emergency that you had to quickly get this product approved, or else people would suffer, and yet it was approved without any clinical trials. So then the instant replay, that had happened with Renew with Moisture Lock in 2006. In 2007, almost exactly a year later, another product called Complete Moisture Plus was also approved by the FDA with no clinical trials, also a contact lens solution, and also that caused actually a parasite, lovely thought, in their eyes, and that also caused blindness. Now, has the FDA learned from their mistakes? They're now considering, I believe still in the process of considering, a treatment called NeuroStar, which is a treatment for depression, another issue that's very important to women. Also being considered as substantially equivalent, this time to electric shock therapy. NeuroStar is actually magnetic pulses to the brain. It looks a little bit like a dentist's chair. You sit in it, you put this thing on your head, and it's supposed to put magnetic pulses to your brain to make you feel happier. The treatment's about an hour a day, 5 days a week, for about 6 weeks straight. So it's very inconvenient, must be done by a doctor, so very expensive. It's a completely different mechanism than electric shock therapy. It's outpatient, it's not inpatient. It's daily instead of rarely. And the other thing is it works just as well whether you turn the machine on or off. So one would have to say, not statistically significantly better than placebo. Placebo works quite well in this case. If you get somebody to come in every day and sit in this chair for an hour and they have to pay some money, they're going to tend to feel better. But they feel better whether the machine's on or off. So I just want to give a few examples. I'm almost done. A few examples of what does substantial equivalence mean for FDA devices. And I like this example because steak and milk both come from cows. And they're both food. But I don't think anybody would say these are substantially equivalent. Now, these are devices that were used for jaw implants, the ones that look like hardware for your, you know, your car, was actually the jaw implant that was approved, called Vitek. It was approved as substantially equivalent to silicone sheeting. That's a sheet. You can see they don't look alike. The material's different. The Vitek implant had Teflon on it. Unfortunately, the jaw is the most used joint in the body. The friction from that constant use from talking, eating, singing, kissing, whatever you're doing, breathing, caused flakes of Teflon to get out and caused holes to develop in the skulls of patients who had, some of the patients who had this product. Again, contact lens solution, not substantially equivalent when you had most contact lens solutions and then these other ones that caused these horrible things to happen. This quickly, one more, bladder slings. There were bladder slings made out of different materials. They do look the same. They are used the same way. That's the good news. The bad news was that when Protogen made theirs, they made it out of a completely different material. It ended up causing vaginal deterioration. Women actually had to have their vaginas rebuilt. They had massive infections. And this was for stress incontinence, which, although not a nice thing to have, you know, is not a serious life-threatening condition. So my question is, are apples and oranges equivalent? We always say they're not. It's like apples and oranges, and yet they are both fruit, and they are both good for you. And so similarly with the FDA's substantial equivalence, it's, in our opinion, much too loose of a definition, and as a result, products are being approved. Many, many people are using them. There's often no clinical trials and no data. And just to give you a sense of what it's like, you know, you have the ability to approve a product. A is similar to B, which was similar to C, which is similar to D. So you have, you have products that are approved on the basis of their similarity to another product that was based on its similarity to another product, and even the ones A and B weren't that similar, but believe me, they're nothing like C or A. Okay, so in conclusion, 90% of medical devices are being approved without clinical trials. When studies are required, they're short-term. FDA standards of safety for devices is inadequate compared to prescription drugs, and we all know that even those for prescription drugs are not always as strong as we'd like. And also just to mention that the standards for insurance coverage and for Medicare are often higher than FDA approval, and this is part of the reason why. Usually Medicare will not pay for a medical device, and insurance often will not pay for a medical device if there's no peer-reviewed, published clinical trials. And so these products are being rushed to the market through this FDA loophole, but if you don't have insurance coverage or Medicare coverage, you kind of wonder what's the big rush, because it's not going to get to the people.